Ever noticed how the smartest person in the room rarely wins the argument? How the colleague with the weakest evidence somehow persuades the entire team? There's a hidden architecture to language that most of us never learned, one that separates those who merely speak from those who truly move people. For 2,500 years, this art has shaped history's pivotal moments, yet we've somehow convinced ourselves that facts alone should be enough. Presidential communication wasn't always a performance art. Early American leaders viewed direct public appeals as unseemly, almost monarchical. Lincoln and Washington communicated primarily through formal letters to Congress, maintaining a dignified distance from the masses. Then, Theodore Roosevelt discovered something revolutionary. The presidency itself was a stage, and the president could be both actor and director. Everything changed with mass media. Roosevelt's bully pulpit gave way to FDR's fireside chats, which transformed radio into an intimate conversation with millions. Kennedy's televised debate with Nixon revealed a new truth: how you look matters as much as what you say. By the time Bush's chief of staff casually admitted, from a marketing point of view, you don't introduce new products in August, about the Iraq War rollout, the transformation was complete. Presidential communication had become indistinguishable from selling soap. This shift coincided with journalism's crisis of authority. The 24-hour news cycle devoured substance and excreted spectacle. Cable news fragmented audiences into ideological tribes. By 2009, 63% of Americans believed news organizations were frequently inaccurate. Traditional gatekeepers, editors who once fact-checked and verified, lost their power. Into this vacuum rushed a new reality. The most compelling story wins, regardless of truth. GOP strategist Frank Luntz captured this perfectly. A compelling story, even if factually inaccurate, can be more emotionally compelling than a dry recitation of the truth. Reagan's mythical welfare queen and Clinton's bridge to the 21st century weren't just phrases. They were entire worldviews compressed into memorable images. Meanwhile, Obama, despite his celebrated eloquence, watched his healthcare achievement nearly destroyed because he couldn't craft a narrative simple enough to compete with death panels. The lesson? In modern politics, the best story beats the best policy every single time. Most educated people mistakenly believe powerful communication requires impressive vocabulary. Churchill knew better. Shorter words appeal with greater force. History proves this. I have a dream. Ask not what your country can do for you. Shakespeare saved his shortest words for devastating moments. Lady Macbeth screams, "Out, damned spot," not "remove this sanguinary evidence." Modern culture confirms this everywhere. Bob Dylan built his legacy on simple words. The times they are a-changin'. Reagan demolished Carter with, "Are you better off than you were 4 years ago?" Scientists sabotage themselves. Anthropogenic global warming sounds committee-written. Human-caused warming sounds human. Orwell nailed it. Never use a long word where a short one will do. This isn't dumbing down. It's clearing fog. Short words aren't just easier to understand, they're impossible to forget. When attention spans measure in seconds, simplicity isn't compromise. It's the only strategy that works. Justin Bieber sang "baby" 54 times in one song. It became a global phenomenon. Repetition doesn't just reinforce a message, it creates pleasure in our brains. We're wired to find satisfaction in patterns, which is why TV catchphrases become cultural shorthand. Dynamite, book 'em, Dano. Research confirms what marketers discovered. Hearing something repeatedly makes us believe it's true, even when we know better. Politicians exploit this ruthlessly. Reagan's communications director explained, "This business of saying the same thing over and over and over again, which to a lot of Washington insiders and pundits is boring, works. The most sophisticated speakers use specific techniques. Anaphora repeats words at the beginning of clauses. Think of King's 'I have a dream.' Epistrophe repeats words at the end, like Lincoln's 'government of the people, by the people, for the people.' These aren't flourishes. They're precision tools for embedding ideas in memory." Socrates perfected playing dumb, asking innocent questions that trapped opponents in contradictions. Television gave us Columbo's, "Oh, just one more thing" setup. George W. Bush appeared less articulate than he was, letting opponents underestimate him while thinking three steps ahead, as Carl Rose noted. Verbal irony, saying one thing while meaning another, is rhetoric's sharpest blade. Mark Antony demonstrated this in Julius Caesar's funeral speech, calling the conspirators honorable men 10 times, each repetition dripping with more venom until the crowd spit the word as an insult. He never directly calls them murderers. Dramatic irony creates situations where the audience knows something characters don't. American Idol contestants who can't sing but think they're stars, or the Titanic's captain dismissing iceberg warnings. These narratives satisfy something deep, watching hubris meet reality. The most satisfying stories involve self-inflicted wounds, Shakespeare's hoist with his own petard. Seinfeld perfected this. Every shallow scheme backfired, culminating in a finale where past victims testified against them. We crave these narratives because they suggest the universe has moral architecture, that consequences exist, that actions circle back. Chekhov's rule. If there's a gun hanging on the wall in the first act, it must fire in the last. Martin Luther King's Washington address exemplifies this. His opening, "I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom," prophesies success while introducing freedom repeated 24 times. By echoing Lincoln's fourscore phrasing and standing in Lincoln's shadow, King connects the Emancipation Proclamation to his speech, highlighting the cruel irony that 100 years later, the Negro is still not free. Politicians exploit foreshadowing through origin stories. Barbara Bush reframed her son's childhood stubbornness as presidential tenaciousness. But foreshadowing carries risks. John Kerry built his 2004 candidacy on Vietnam heroism, but failed to complete the narrative arc. When Swift boat attacks came, he had no defensive story ready. The lesson? Foreshadowing without follow-through is worse than none at all. You've raised expectations you can't fulfill. Incomplete foreshadowing doesn't just fail, it actively damages credibility. Aristotle called metaphor creation a sign of genius because it requires perceiving similarity in dissimilars. Cognitive science reveals metaphors don't just decorate language, they structure how we think about abstract concepts, serving as mental shortcuts that categorize chaotic sensory experiences into manageable patterns. Research proves metaphors outperform literal statements in memory tests because they create visual associations and demand deeper processing. Great speakers wield metaphors as weapons. Lincoln gave us "a house divided against itself cannot stand," connecting biblical authority to slavery's moral crisis. Churchill called apt analogies among the most formidable weapons of the rhetorician, creating enduring images like the Iron Curtain. Research confirms charismatic presidents use nearly twice as many metaphors as non-charismatic ones. From the Bible's "The Lord is my shepherd" to Dylan's "She aches just like a woman, but she breaks just like a little girl." Metaphors electrify language. But they carry risk. Sarah Palin's crosshairs targeting Democrats exploded politically. Romney's campaign suffered when his strategist mentioned the Etch-a-Sketch, reinforcing doubts about Romney's convictions. The most powerful rhetorical tool is also the most dangerous. Extended metaphors create entire mental worlds. The Bible uses them extensively. Psalm 23's shepherd imagery, Revelation's allegories. Lady Gaga's poker face frames love as a poker game, while Bad Romance treats it as a Hitchcock thriller. These work because they give listeners complete structures for understanding complex emotions. Lincoln's Gettysburg Address contains a birth-death-resurrection metaphor, reframing military defeat as spiritual renewal in 270 words. Reagan's "Morning in America" captured optimism in one image, while his "Bear in the Woods" ad compared Russia to a dangerous bear only he could confront. Lakoff and Johnson show metaphor is pervasive in everyday life, not just in language, but in thought and action. The argument is war metaphor dominates politics. Your claims are indefensible. He attacked every weak point. We don't just talk about arguments as wars, we think about them that way. The metaphor structures reality itself. Successful campaigns create two extended metaphors, positive for themselves, negative for opponents. Obama built everything around change we can believe in. Clinton ran as the establishment candidate, the safer choice, creating fundamental incoherence that cost her the nomination. As Lakoff explains, when the facts don't fit the frames are kept and the facts are ignored. Understanding these techniques makes you immune to manipulation. When you recognize how indirect suggestion plants ideas, how repetition manufactures consensus, how metaphors frame reality, you become harder to seduce. Notice metaphors in tomorrow's headlines, count repetitions in political speeches, identify foreshadowing in your favorite show. Master these ancient techniques, and you change what's possible.